Our next speakers, and that's a plural, Professor Loveday Conquest with the Aquatic and Fishery Sciences and graduate student Morgan Sternberg will be talking today about the efficacy and potential for non-target effects of larvicides for West Nile virus control in Seattle catch basins. Loveday?
Good morning. Every research effort is a team effort, and I'd like to just acknowledge Chris Grew is the head of the Washington Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Unit. Martin Grassley is scientific staff, and Morgan Sternberg, who'll be talking today, and Karenza King are graduate students. And that little mosquito up there is life size, so definitely something we need to pay attention to. Let me give you a bit of general background regarding Washington State and West Nile virus. I will be talking about the sampling schemes for studies that were done in 2006 and 2007. 2006 was kind of a pilot year, had to do with larval abundance results and efficacy for the three larvicides that Seattle Public Utilities was interested in trying out. And then Morgan will be speaking on efficacy for watershed basin sets, something of critical importance, and a 2007 study for outflow monitoring and potential for non-target effects. Okay. A little bit of history of Washington State and West Nile virus. You may recall that the New York Times in the late 1990s reported West Nile virus in the state of New York. Since that time, appearances in Washington State have occurred in 2002, 2005, and 2006. There's a number and type of potential mosquito vectors and two genus, I'm not sure if I can pronounce this correctly, Aedes and Culex are shown there. Definitely species of concern for urban areas, and we'll be talking about different habitats that these mosquitoes are associated with. On the title slide, there were some photographs of catch basins, and I'm sure you have seen all of these on a rainy day in Seattle. The Round Top on the left, of which there are many, I think over 40,000, and the Graded Top catch basins within the city of Seattle that catch a lot of our runoff water. Seattle Public Utilities was interested in particular zones and sectors in the city of Seattle. So here's a map that shows where our sampling frame had to start from. So we were interested in single family, neighborhood commercial, and the multifamily zone. So anything that's in the gray or the dotted area was subject to sampling. The white areas, which were largely sort of downtown commercial or large industrial, were not part of this sampling frame. So in 2006, which was kind of, I think of it as the pilot year, the pilot summer, the project sampling scheme, we did a citywide monitoring to look for larval abundance. So there were 250 round-top untreated basins monitored from June to September. And it was stratified sampling because the previous map showed you three strata, and the number of basins was proportional to city sector and zone, so proportional stratified sampling. There was also a small efficacy study done in the northwest sector, also done through the summer, and we'll look at the results from that. 15 round-top basins for the four treatment groups, so the control group and three larvicide treatment groups. In 2007, there was more citywide monitoring with 150 round-top basins monitored through the summer. SPU was actually principally concerned with round-top basins, and we added a couple of graded-top basins. So, and it is true that there are many, many more round-top than graded-tops, and that's one reason for the highly unequal number of treated and control round-top basins and then treated and control graded-top basins. Efficacy studies were done on basins from the Thornton, Pipers, and Longfellow watershed. And there was also a study that Morgan will talk about concerning certain sites from those same three watersheds as to what happens at the outflow, looking for non-target effects. So in 2006, this is a graph of mosquito larvae abundance, average larvae per dip taken in a very standard sampling protocol of 3 dips. And the beginning of the summer, let's see, okay. That's very near the, so week 25, very near the end of June up to week 39, near the end of September. And in what I would term sort of an ordinary, mostly dry summer, not surprisingly, the spring rains kind of keep the abundance down, and then as you move into the dry summer, end of June, early July, or through July, August, and into September, so the abundance peaks and then comes down as the fall rains begin. Okay. The three larvicides of interest, Thuringiensis and Bacillus fericus, henceforth known as BTI and BS, okay, for ease of pronunciation, and methoprene in briquettes, BTI and BS act by killing the larvae, and so they, for the appropriate response variable for them is to look at the number of pupae per 3 dips. Methoprene prevents the emergence of the pupae to adulthood, and so methoprene has a different response variable, percent emergence success. So the results for 2006, on the left shows the BS and BTI efficacy, and you can see that both of them are efficacious. They definitely control the number of pupae per 3 dips, and the BS was a little more efficacious. Its curve comes down faster, and it really stays down there. The curve on the right is the efficacy for methoprene, which was, I would say, mostly efficacious, but there's a peak near the end of the summer, and that also coincides with a peak in precipitation. And so the conclusion there is probably that there's a dilution effect, and hence you get that jump in the percent emergence for methoprene. So the conclusions from the 2006 initial pilot summer study was that mosquito season generally lasts from mid-June through September, and the BS was most effective. And now I'll turn it over to Morgan.
So because in 2006 the BS product was most efficacious, Seattle Public Utilities decided to treat all of the catch basins within the city of Seattle with another BS product. And we had 3 or 4 objectives for 2007 research. The first was to look at the efficacy of that treatment citywide. We also wanted to look at the efficacy of the larvicide in 3 different sets of basins that were associated with 3 watersheds, the Longfellow, Thornton, and Piper's Creek watersheds. We also wanted to monitor different outflow points along those watersheds to determine whether or not the BS was able to enter into those local surface waters. And finally, we wanted to conduct 2 different toxicity tests using juvenile coho salmon to determine whether or not there was any non-target effects associated with them. So I just want to discuss briefly the methods for the citywide efficacy and abundance monitoring. We again looked at abundance of larvae and pupae from June through September, and we monitored various water quality parameters, inclusive, of course, of larvae and pupae. And to analyze our data, we used a one-sided Mann-Whitney test as well as graphical comparisons to look at abundance through time. This is a pretty busy slide, but stay with me here. This is showing the 3 different sets of treatment weeks that we looked at in the citywide monitoring. So the city treated across 3 different weeks, and we had to select 50 basins per week to monitor through time. So these are those 3 different weeks monitored. And all the axes are the same, the average mosquito pupae per 3 dips on the Y, and time and week along the X-axis. The most important thing to take away from this slide is notice there are these 2 boxed weeks in the various treatment weeks. And those indicate the only 2 weeks wherein the treatment, the BS treatment, was not efficacious. So therefore, with round-top basins, the treatment was efficacious pretty much throughout the whole summer, regardless of the increased precipitation that we found occurred during the summer of 2007. That is in contrast to the graded top basins that we monitored. And again, we have along the y-axis average pupae per three dips, and weak is along the x-axis. This rectangle actually represents the week wherein the treatment was efficacious. So there was only 1 week for the graded top basins within which they saw efficacy. So basically, the round top basins realized efficacy for much longer than the graded top basins. And we believe that one of the main reasons for this is that we had a large amount of precipitation in 2007, and we believe that when the water enters into the graded top basins, it enters at a more severe angle than it does when it enters through the round top basins, which may allow for a greater degree of mixing of the larvicide within the graded top basins, thus allowing it to flow out of the basins more easily and sometimes into local watersheds. Now I'd like to discuss the methods for the monitoring of the watershed basin sets. Again, there were three associated with the three watersheds. We monitored them 2 weeks pre-treatment all the way up through 11 weeks post-treatment. And again, we were using the average pupae per three dips as the efficacy indicator. We collected water samples from these basin sets pre-treatment all the way up through 7 weeks post-treatment in most cases to determine essentially the fate of the BS and the BTI through time. And this is a graph depicting the efficacy for each one of those three watershed basin sets. We have the Longfellow basin set here, Piper's in blue, and Thornton is in red. And we also have this control as a reference point here for you. The most important thing to notice from this graph is that both the Longfellow and Piper's sets maintained pretty consistently low average pupae counts, whereas the Thornton basin set increased in pupae counts approximately 3 weeks post-treatment. And we believe that that lack of efficacy in the Thornton watershed that occurred in week 5 post-treatment was due to the fact that those basins were comprised primarily of graded top basins, and we saw from the previous results that those basins lost efficacy much more quickly than the round top basins did. And now I will discuss some of our outflow sampling. Again, just to remind you, we had three different watersheds, two outflow sites in Piper's Creek, 5 in the Thornton Creek area, and 3 in the Longfellow Creek area. This is a picture of a normal outflow. This is actually taken from a Piper's Creek site. So we monitored these outflow sites in sort of two different ways. We used baseline monitoring, which is essentially collecting water samples outside of precipitation events. And then we also looked at collecting samples immediately following precipitation events with the idea that there would be the greatest pulse of larvicide to the system as the basins overflowed. And again, we compared these concentrations of Bacillus ferricus and BTI through time, just graphically. And I would now like to discuss the methodology for our two different toxicity tests that we conducted. They were standard 96-hour toxicity tests using juvenile coho salmon. The first test used a BS product, a BTI product, and a methoprene product individually. And in the second test, we used those in various combinations to determine whether or not there could be synergistic effects, for example. We used 50-gallon drums, and we added the juvenile coho into those drums when the larvicides were at maximum concentration. So we dosed at maximum concentration, and the fish stayed in there for 96 hours. We collected water samples at time zero and then also at 96 hours. And this actually is a picture of the BTI product, which is mosquito dunks and bits, and it floats. It has a corn cob mixture, so it tends to float on the surface and remain in the water column for a little bit longer. This is sort of a general graph here, but the most important thing I should tell you, first of all, is that we saw no adverse effects at all on juvenile coho salmon in either one of those tests, regardless of the maximum concentration that we dosed with. And this is a graph showing the maximum concentrations of BS, which is in this pink color here, and BTI in blue, for each of the outflows, and then also the maximum concentration of both of those larvicides in the toxicity test drum. And this slide is really used as a comparison slide so that you can see the fish that were exposed here didn't have any adverse effects associated. And therefore, in the wild, when they are exposed to these relatively lower amounts of BTI and BS, they would probably not experience adverse effects either. So, in conclusion here, we actually detected very little Bacillus sphericus in most of our samples, and we believe that may be partially due to different sort of growing conditions that BTI can sort of grow better in than the BS can. And again, we found no adverse effects of the larvicides on juvenile coho despite the maximum concentrations applied and despite the fact that those coho were held in that maximum concentration for 96 hours as opposed to the pulses they would have experienced in the wild. And the general summary here is well, basically, the need for larvicide treatment could be construed as weather-dependent. If we were omniscient beings and able to predict that we were going to have a very wet summer, that might allow us to say that the larvae and pupae counts could be held down to the levels comparable to what we would expect if we dosed with larvicides. But since we're not omniscient and we are in a time right now where we're still concerned about West Nile virus transmission, it probably still is necessary to treat those basins. The good news is that the Vectilex product, or the BS and BTI, caused no adverse effects in juvenile coho, and it was very effective at reducing the mosquito larvae and pupae populations. So if we have to use it, this is probably the best product to use. And in addition, we did look at the outflow concentrations from outflows in Thornton Creek in 2008, and we found that there were even lower levels of the BS and the BTI. So that's again, very good news for juvenile coho. And I would just like to say thank you to all of the many associations that helped us with this research, and especially our funding agency, Seattle Public Utilities.
Do we have some time for some questions?
Did you bring into your study the residents along these various streams, the City of Seattle Wastewater Streams and Runoff Committee, and or John Lombard, et cetera? Was anybody other than the university involved in the study on a long-going effect of what's going on there? But specifically out at the Piper Creek would be Nancy Malmgren, Longfellow would be Bobby Anderson, and Thornton Creek would be Gary Minton. Were any of them brought into your studies? And if not, will you go ahead and bring them into your studies?
That's a good question. They have not been brought into our studies thus far. Actually, I'd love to get those names from you later on. But perhaps as the study continues, they might, you know, be brought in if we continue. I know that Seattle Public Utilities is doing some similar work, and they may be associated with those folks that you mentioned. So,
question back there.
You're using the larvicide
That's a great question. And actually, Seattle Public, the request, I'm sorry, I was already told to do that. The question are the larvicide products that we were looking at, could they affect any other biota other than looking at directly juvenile coho salmon? And the answer is, the good news about BTI and BS is that they are fairly specific. However, they do affect other diptera, and specifically black fly larvae. The Seattle Public Utilities does have a division that is looking at the effects perhaps on other invertebrates, but we didn't include that in our study. Right. We didn't talk about methoprene I'm sorry. The question was, could we address how methoprene perhaps affects invertebrates, and then also why didn't we address the effects of methoprene in our results? And we didn't discuss methoprene specifically in our results this time because the city has opted at this point not to use a methoprene product, and we really wanted to be specific to what the city was using and is planning to use. But the methoprene product had no adverse effect at all on the juvenile coho salmon, despite the maximum concentrations, and also when those were combined with other larvicides. And you know, I'm trying to think. I don't know exactly what other invertebrates might be affected by methoprene, so I would have to get back to you on that.
Question back there.
Have we given any thought to the indirect effects of perhaps the salmon eating something that had been exposed to the larvicide? And no, we haven't given thought to that yet. That would be a very interesting question to pursue.
The next master's
yeah.
One other question here.
And that's another great question. Could there be genetic mutations or potential long-term effects that we didn't specifically look at in our toxicity work? And that's absolutely possible. Again, that's kind of beyond what we did here, but good question.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
I'm sorry, has the city thought about introducing bat boxes as a control for mosquitoes? I can't answer that. I don't know. But I've had various comments along those lines, like mosquito fish in the basins, and perhaps they are considering many options. But I don't know.
I think there's time for one more question.
How long does it take the larvicides that we looked at to break down in the environment? Well, that varies. They are all 30-day products that we looked at. But if there is significant precipitation, that can reduce the concentration of it in the environment. So it's difficult exactly for us to tell. But as a general rule, what we saw in 2006, given no precipitation, was that they were found in the environment for at least 7 weeks post-treatment.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.